they need to treat them. So provincial departments commit this to unfunded spending or the use of these accruals to minimize medical legal claims as well. So in terms of our recommendations, if you move to the next slide, what we are saying is that there needs to be a much more clearer signaling. Signaling of when provincial departments of health are under pressure. And therefore that there needs to be a framework or criteria for determining serious financial strain with clear measurable financial and non-financial factors that can be monitored, reported and used to trigger automatic fiscal adjustments, and that this should be overseen by the provincial legislature. Secondly, we need a solution for addressing the significant expenditure accruals that exist. As at 2016-17, accruals within the health sector amounted to 13.8 billion rand. So we need a way of addressing that. And what we recommend is that the National Treasury and Department of Health allocate part of the 2019 health infrastructure budget towards gradually offsetting those expenditure accruals. Because that 13.8 billion is expenditure that took place, or, well, an amount that provinces didn't have, but they are committing to fund from their upcoming budget. So we need to find a way of addressing that, and we are saying use the health infrastructure budget to gradually offset that. But of course this needs to be conditional upon provinces meeting targets around reductions in accruals. Then our third recommendation is about building in some space or flexibility in the system to ensure that provincial health departments have some cushioning during times of fiscal stress. We therefore recommend that the National Treasury should ensure that the framework for health infrastructure conditional grants accommodates flexibility during periods of protracted fiscal constraints, so that provinces can essentially reallocate available capital allocations towards operational expenditure such as maintenance. Thank you, Chair. I'll hand over to Khalid to take you through the last part of the presentation.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, honourable members. So this chapter deals with incentive effects of intergovernmental grants. As we all know, there's been significant baseline reductions to intergovernmental transfers to local government. And as you can see in this graph, the green bar shows us the growth of the equitable share, local government equitable share, and the red line there shows us the growth of your conditional grants to local government. And as you can see that from 2008-09 onwards, there's been a significant decline of conditional grants as well as local government equitable share. And you can see there that the most significant reductions have been to your conditional grants relative to your equitable share. And these reductions are taking place within the context of a very tight fiscal envelope and also reprioritization at the national level. And it raises two very important questions. One very important question: in the context of these reductions, what impact does this have on municipal expenditure and revenues? Are there any incentives municipalities respond to when the conditional grants and equitable share are reduced? Well, there are two competing views on the matter. The one view goes along, states that when you reduce intergovernmental transfers, especially conditional grants, it incentivizes municipalities to find creative ways of actually increasing their own revenue, so that they can actually improve their own autonomy. So they no longer rely on intergovernmental transfers to fund their services, but rather focus more on trying to generate income through their own revenue. The other alternative view is that if you don't have a board base, a tax base in your municipality, it can actually increase inequalities across different municipalities, particularly in a case where municipalities don't, for example, have those levers like other large municipalities. So what's this? If we can just move on to the next slide. Okay, so what this this particular chapter attempts to do is to answer two questions. The first one is, how responsive are intergovernmental grants that's received by municipalities with respect to revenue generated by the municipalities? So, like I said, do reductions in conditional grants stimulate own revenue collection, etc., etc.? And the second question is, does South Africa's grant allocation framework lead to grant-driven crowding out or crowding in behavior among recipient municipalities? So that second question is there to test that if you are going to be transferring or rather increasing intergovernmental transfers, are municipalities going to sit back and decide that they're not going to go out and try to increase their own revenue collection? So we're trying to test what are the incentives in relation to the current context, which is the reduced allocation to conditional grants in particular. Now moving on to the next slide. So when we looked at the data, we found that the findings suggest a very different picture across different types of municipalities. So in the case of metropolitan municipalities, conditional grants actually positively correlate own revenue collection. In other words, it provides incentive to municipalities to actually increase own revenue collection. Whereas increased funding of capital and also it increases capital outlays as well. So if you increase conditional grant transfers, municipalities tend to also be incentivized to collect own revenue because and also it increases capital spending, largely because conditional grants are capital driven in nature. With regard to your secondary cities, your equitable share is positively correlated with own revenue, while unconditional grant transfers negatively impact operational expenditure. With respect to your large towns or your B2 municipalities, we find that our equitable share has a positive effect on own revenue and expenditure per capita, but conditional grant allocations induce lower per capita outlays on capital and operational goods. Now, with respect to your smaller towns, we find that your equitable share is also incentivizes own revenue and capital and certain recurrent components of municipal spending, while conditional grants aid higher per capita spending on capital and operational goods and services. And finally, your rural municipalities, your equitable share incentivizes own revenue and also different components of municipal spending, while conditional grants tend to lower capital expenditure. So as you can see, there's a different incentives on different types of municipalities, and therefore the underlying message of here is that we should avoid the one-size-fits-all approach and approach each or different categories of municipalities with a different population of interventions. Now moving on to our recommendations, and for this particular chapter we've got two recommendations that we've made. The one recommendation is that the Minister of Finance through National Treasury should give municipalities, particularly those in small and rural municipalities, greater flexibility in the use of grants to encourage innovative approaches to resolving local problems. And here we are suggesting that we should try to move towards a situation where municipalities are able to fund a wide variety of services through these conditional grants. And currently what we find is conditional grants are very specific in the way that they are designed, and quite often municipalities are unable to spend all of the funding because in a particular municipality maybe that's not the priority. But because the grant conditions is that they've only got to spend it on A, that's all that they spend it on. And what we are suggesting is to improve efficiencies, let's rather broaden the scope of the grant so that municipalities have more flexibility in terms of how they can actually use the funding to address the unique situation. The second recommendation calls for fiscal capacity control to be introduced in the equitable share formula to make it more efficient and incentivizing. So currently in the equitable local government equitable share formula, there is a revenue adjustment component, but that only takes into consideration revenue capacity and not revenue effort. And what we are suggesting here is that in order to incentivize municipalities to boost all the revenue collection, we should introduce a revenue effort criteria. We should deal with two components, the revenue raising effort, but also at the same time there should be equity component as well, so that the formula is redistributed. Honourable Chair, moving on to the next chapter, and in this chapter we assess the efficiency of key provincial infrastructure programs, and we focused on three areas: health, education and public transport. Now as we know, South Africa is currently focusing on investing in driving growth through infrastructure delivery. But infrastructure on its own is not going to translate into economic growth. There has to be efficient and effective utilization of the resources for that to happen. And the research demonstrates that more efficient countries in the way that they spend the infrastructure funding achieves twice the economic or growth dividend relative to other countries. And so this particular chapter attempted to assess the current efficiency of provincial infrastructure, but also within the prevailing fiscal context to ask the question, how can provincial governments achieve the same level of infrastructure delivery with less money? Moving on to the next slide, what are some of the key findings that emanated from our research? Well, the first finding that we came across is that the cuts to provincial infrastructure grants is going to slow infrastructure delivery in the provinces in the short term. And we found evidence for that across all of the provinces. However, in the medium term, provinces can absorb these spending cuts, but only through efficiency gains, particularly if provinces are able to address capacity gaps by making sure that there are infrastructure procurement and built environment personnel at your sector departments as well as your implementing agents as well. The second finding is that aligning your planning, budgeting and implementation functions of provincial infrastructure delivery leads to better outcomes. So currently these functions are separated between sector departments and implementing agents, thus distorting incentives and weakening the accountability chain. So we found that in some provinces, they are allowed to sector departments are allowed to procure their own infrastructure. And in those particular instances, you actually find better utilization of funds compared to when that sector department has to implement an infrastructure project through an implementing agent like your public works or other implementing agents. And then what we found from our survey results is that 91% of our respondents felt government procurement processes are not open and transparent, while 57% agreed corruption is most prominent during the procurement and tender phases of the infrastructure cycle. Now, when the respondents were asked what percentage of the contract value is paid in full payments or inducements to get government contracts, only 14% no payments were made, while 76% said payments were made between 3 to 12% of the contract value to secure a government contract. And for this, contractors pay a higher percentage of the contract value for smaller contracts relative to larger contracts, except in a few instances. We also, the assessment of the value chain, infrastructure value chain at provincial level, also revealed that there's a lack of oversight at key delivery points, and this is increasing incentives to engage in fiscal misappropriation. And some of the key challenges in the value chain And we've highlighted just three of here, is that consultants are often incentivized to over-design projects because their payment is often based on a percentage of the project cost. So you often find the security departments complaining to say that when they get to see what the design of this particular school is, it's the design is to win awards rather than to make it functional. And one of the reasons for that is because these consultants that are recruited to design these schools, their payment is often linked to the actual value of the project cost. There's also no third-party review of tenders awarded by implementing agents, even though they are solely responsible for appointing contractors with very little participation from security departments. So there's no third-party review, even though these implementing agents almost exclusively has complete say in terms of who actually gets awarded the infrastructure project. And then finally, permanent on-site supervision of contractors is largely absent, allowing for concealment of defects and the use of poor quality material. We all know the challenges that we have with schools after 2 or 3 years having massive problems with quality precisely because there has been poor oversight during the construction process of these infrastructure projects. Now moving on to the recommendations. This chapter, Chair, we make three recommendations. The first one is that the National Sector Departments of Education, Health and Public Transport should develop a clear performance evaluation framework for provincial infrastructure grants under their control. Now, the reason why we made this recommendation is that we've implemented infrastructure projects for a long time, well over a decade. Yet, we are unable to say whether our delivery of infrastructure has improved over the time. Even though we have attempted to improve delivery, we can't say for sure whether infrastructure delivery has actually improved. And this is the reason why we've made this recommendation, so that we are able to benchmark how infrastructure delivery is actually being implemented across the different provinces. The second recommendation we've made is that the National Sector Departments of Education, Health and Public Transport should include greater scrutiny of requests of variation orders when the value of these rise above acceptable level of project costs. Now, in our findings, we found that variation orders is one of the main means by which project costs tend to escalate. And here we are calling for greater scrutiny of these variation orders so that government is able to achieve value for money, and that these variation orders are not being processed, which should not be processed. And then finally, the last recommendation we've made is that the Minister of Finance to the National Treasury should set and publish the criteria to be measured in monitoring and evaluating infrastructure grants. The assessment of criteria regarding infrastructure cuts should also be published. So currently, government has cut provincial infrastructure grants, but we don't know on what basis those cuts have been made. And here we are calling for the criteria by which government decides to cut infrastructure grants to be made transparent, so that we know on what basis those cuts are actually being made. And Chairperson, moving on to the final chapter of our submission. And here we are assessing the effectiveness of intergovernmental fiscal relations instruments in addressing water challenges. Chair, as you know, achieving water security is the overarching goal of national water management. And a key question that we attempted to achieve in this particular chapter is that do our fiscal instruments and other missions that are introduced in the intergovernmental fiscal relations framework help to achieve the NDP's goal of ensuring affordable and reliable access to sufficient water and hygienic sanitation for all. And when we look at some of the statistics with respect to water services, we find that, generally speaking, we're quite close to households receiving the minimum standard of infrastructure across the country. As well as piped water in houses or stand. There are exceptions, and this is particularly with respect to our rural provinces, we have not achieved our minimum targets. With respect to reliability of water supply, we see that 85% of infrastructure is functional, but only 65% is reliably functioning. So we have a massive problem with respect to ensuring that our water infrastructure is operating reliably. Unfortunately, we are unable to monitor water safety any longer because the data is no longer being published by the Department of Water and Sanitation. And of course, as we know, sanitation indicators is unsatisfactory, particularly with respect to wastewater treatment failures that we know is quite prevalent across the municipalities. Moving on to the next slide. This slide basically shows us the breakdown of the intergovernmental fiscal instruments that are utilized to provide water services. Equitable shares largely utilized to provide maintenance and operational support to water services. And whilst refurbishment and upgrade is funded through three conditional grants, a regional bulk infrastructure grant, your municipal infrastructure grant, as well as your water service infrastructure grant. And as you can see, when you read through what the objectives of those grants are, many of them are overlapping. And that's a big concern from the Commission's perspective. Moving on to the next slide. What are some of the key findings that emanate from the study? As we have identified, there are significant spending that is taking place in the sector, but access to safe and reliable water services is declining. Also, inadequate expenditure on operations and maintenance is leading to service failures. So we are pumping a lot of money into infrastructure, but we're not making provision to maintain and maintain that particular infrastructure. So the current IGF also took things to incentivize over provisional infrastructure, but without providing operating and maintenance costs, as we've just indicated now. Moving on to the next slide. What we found also is that providing higher and basic water standards with limited revenue collection aggravates municipal, water board and national departments' financial deficits. We also find that there's poorly defined grant objectives that allow substantial deviation from the policy. And in this respect, we are particularly concerned with the regional bulk infrastructure grant. As when you look at the objectives, it tends to know who's actually accountable and how reporting should actually take place. Moving on to our recommendations that we've made. We've made a number of recommendations in this chapter, but we've just selected the most important recommendations that we thought is important to identify and bring to your attention, honourable members. The first recommendation calls for a review of the basic norms and standards for water services by the Department of Water and Sanitation. Also, what we have identified is that there needs to be standards set by municipalities in terms of what standards they're going to provide for water services to. And they need to indicate where the source of the operational and capital spending is going to come from. I think this is quite important because currently we know that capital expenditure is being covered, but municipalities are not sufficiently budgeting for operational expenditure. Also, the Commission is of the view that in a time of fiscal constraint, we need to focus more aggressively on operating and maintenance costs, as building new infrastructure without the requisite operational expenditure is going to lead to a situation where we are going to reduce the lifespan of our infrastructure because we don't have sufficient funding to maintain the infrastructure that we actually build. Also, with respect to the conditional grants framework, we'll make a couple of recommendations. The first one is that the objectives need to be clearer so that we know exactly what the grant is actually funding. But also at the same time, there needs to be stronger conditions attached with respect to monitoring and oversight of infrastructure. Currently, municipalities are not implementing proper oversight over the infrastructure, and we need to make sure that the conditions are tightened so that municipalities improve the oversight and monitoring of infrastructure. And finally, the IGFR system should incentivize sustainable operations and maintenance and introduce a dimension of outcome-based support for higher levels of service. Chi, on that note, I'd like to hand over to our chairperson to conclude with final remarks.
Thank you, sir. Prof?
Thank you, Chair. In many ways, this submission that we've made to you is only the fast track you through it. You can't see this on its own. You have to go through the whole submission. And the reason I'm raising that because many a times the question that gets asked is actually in the document. But also, there also needs to be read with previous submissions that we have made, which actually, because it's part of empowering honorable members to be able to engage with these issues, because we know there's not that much time. That's why we've taken through this. Before I deal with this slide, I just wanted to say, especially as it relates to the water chapter, and in particular in this province, I think it is important that honourable members know, chairperson, that with the water shortages and also with the load shedding of electricity, the revenue stream, those two revenue streams from municipalities has been affected. It's had a huge impact on municipalities' revenue streams. And because of that, it is conceivable then that municipalities will look at other avenues of revenue. And our preliminary indication is that the property tax is the next attack, where it's going to bring a further a shock to households who come out of, you know, the gap in the middle class, whether it's at the low end or the higher end, where those households is going to be seriously affected. We don't know the nature of it as yet, but it is conceivable that it's a matter that this provincial legislature needs to keep its eye on. I would humbly recommend that you need to think about that, especially when it comes to revenue and taxation in this province. Because it's going to happen, and it is going to create a destabilizing effect on households and on businesses. So there's a need to think about that. And we haven't dealt with it because we're going to come in the next submission in the municipalities matter on that. But it's a critical thing because it's going to impact on the functionality of the municipalities. I don't know how much revenue the Western Cape municipalities, in particular the city, has lost. But it's a worrying matter, and it's probably conceivable to make sure that or rather to ask the Treasury of the province also to look at that. The second thing I thought that's linked to that, which is the issue of non-payment. The people that don't pay or the people that opt out of payment is actually the middle class, the rich in this province and in other provinces. So what they do is the preliminary information that where I'm sitting in another process shows that because I'm the chair of the advisory panel on electricity electrification between the fallout between Salva and Eskom and all that. But it shows in this province that because of the minimum basket of service, people starting to beat the system in this province. That the middle class rich utilize the services at a certain point, and then they get off the grids, and they use the mixed energy, but also the other water harvesting opportunities, and that in itself also cuts down on the stream of revenue stream to the municipality. And some of these things, honorable members and politicians don't know because the transactional relationship between, how do I put this, between councillors and provincial legislators is quite close and tight, and sometimes the information in the interest of citizens doesn't get properly looked at. And I'm suggesting that there is a need for you to look at those particular two cuts on the stream of revenue to municipalities as a result of bad behavior on the one end, but on the other side because of a restraint on the water supply services and people opting out of the electricity provision. So Chair, the central message that we bring to you in terms of this submission is that there's an urgent need to properly understand the country's economic challenges and to address them specifically and directly and to see exactly what's the impact on the Western Cape as a province as a whole. Second is the need to establish a balanced fiscal position that can be sustained over the long term. And our third point that we'd like to make is that efficiency of all government activity must be sharpened. We think that it's time that we start setting the standard of measure for performance in different sectors, because it can't only be based on what the policy wants, and then you get policy and legislative compliance to malicious compliance, but they also have to look at it at a 3 feet level of how we actually measure the performance of various sectors, even to going down to the school level at times, but also going down to the hospital level in other parts, and going down to the transport agencies where they exist, so that the residents receive the best possible value for money from the taxes they pay. But also not forgetting this element of solidarity with the poor, where there's no disposable income or incomes just to help keep a household afloat. Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson.
Honourable members, are we still together? Prof and to the entire FST team, thank you very much. I think from my side, I've been listening carefully and I take the suggestion and the very good advice to interrogate the material that has been submitted to us and that to utilize the content therefore in executing our mandate and responsibility of oversight. I take also the point that municipalities tend not to do proper oversight over the projects that they implement, especially looking closely at the qualitative nature of the project, of the product that has been implemented. So as the chairperson of the Standing Committee on Local Government and Local Government Oversight, so I'm wearing that cap. I will be looking closely at that with my committee, which is the Standing Committee on Local Government. And in actual fact, if one looks at where expenditure takes place, the municipalities are at the coalface of service delivery. So if things go wrong and drastically wrong there, it collapses the entire economy, because companies tend to move away where there's no services, where there's no proper infrastructure, they don't want to invest, they say we can't come here. The question though that I would like to get answered, a proper response to, is your study and obviously the recommendation on the conditional grant and the equitable share. That is a very interesting analogy that you've come up with, that perhaps giving more on the equitable share rather than, I mean, vis-a-vis what you would otherwise give on the conditional grant would increase the capacity and expenditure, or that rather the ability for municipalities to deliver services. I would like to interrogate that further, because I think that is Mr. Dawood that was raising that point on your presentation. I would be very much interested to know how to arrive at that point. In the province here, we've had In many cases, the rural municipality is having a problem on the part of abusing the funding that comes with the conditional grant. And in some cases here, we had to call a municipality that was Canada who said, come here. They wanted to use a conditional grant to implement, to pay loans with the bank, which is taking a loan, giving a guarantee through a conditional grant to pay escrow. And we brought them here, Chairperson. And we brought the National Treasury, the Provincial Treasury, and the Department of Local Government. We were called gangsters here, such names were used, because we told them, you can't do it. And they said, this is a group of gangsters who doesn't like us. We said, you will not do it. And the bank refused the loan, to grant them a loan. So that is how far we take oversight. But it should have been stopped at that level. Why did it have to come here? Why did it take the Standing Committee on Local Government to do that when you have councillors who play oversight? But then that talks to the quality of councillors we elect and the capacity. So I'm raising that as a point of flag for the implementation or the applicability of what we are proposing, especially on those two areas of funding. And other issues, Chair, were raised here on the expenditure by this province that we're spending less when it comes to human settlements. That was 80%, which is the lowest compared to the rest we are at. If you look at the Western, at the Eastern Cape, which is 91% or so, which in their expenditure. If you go to the Eastern Cape, I know in Gala and in Takastad, there are thousands of houses unoccupied because there's no beneficiaries. I'm just using that as an anecdote. But if you look at the Western Cape and the demand, and you look at the influx, I was born in Tholo in Eastern Cape. Inanna was born in Sterkspruit. I'm just mentioning two here. And the reality, are you there? I know you are a Cape born. Yeah. But the point here is that, Chairperson, there is a point there to be made, and it's valid. But if you dig deeper, now you understand why the Western Cape would not have many people housed. In fact, it does not say underspending. It says the housed, people who are properly housed. And because it talks about the amount of proper housing in the Western Cape. We've got a number of informal settlements here. If you look on the N1, on the Bed and Power, you think it's a new town because people have taken the land and have occupied the land without following due process. Because people are frustrated, they need a place to live. And you go throughout the province. Yesterday there was an interpellation on this area about how much has been spent by municipalities on getting security to protect what is called private land, a public land, from being occupied illegally. Millions of rands are spent in that area. So I'm just flagging this issue that when you do the assessment of that specific area of the number of proper shelters, do you look at what are the contributing factors? I will look into the report and whether you are able to dive into that area. That's all from my side. Honorable members, Honorable Schaefer, Honorable Inanna, Honorable Kevedo, and Honorable Jaja, and Honorable Simas in that order. Thank you, Honorable members.
Thank you very much, Chair. I think just really, I'd ask the Commission to look at, you're predicting a growth of 2%. We know that we're not there. They're looking at a 1.4, maybe even less, and whether that prediction, and I know you say it should be accelerated to 4.5%, we're talking about numbers that we're still praying for at this point. So aren't they overinflated? the numbers that you put forward. And looking at a worst case scenario, should you not be presenting perhaps the worst case scenario and then actually talking from that point? And then the second point really is, I'm encouraging you to, I mean, the revenue stream for local municipalities has to be relooked. You can't be punishing middle class for looking at alternatives and renewables and taking their homes and the way they live forward into a new fourth industrial revolution, for example. So disruption will just continue. Should you not be advising local government on how to re-look at a revenue stream in the modern world? We keep looking at what we have been doing, but the world is changing. We need to look at a revenue stream that is different and that still continues to supply local municipalities with finance.
Thank you, Honourable Schaefer. Honourable Dinan.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the presentation made. And Prophet, on your opening remarks, you said that for the past 3 years, there were recommendations that were made to the provincial parliament that were never captured, or that were never implemented. I would be glad if you can make them today so that we can know what is it that you recommended and where are the failures, because our responsibilities, the majority of us here, we're on the standing committee so that we can see what might be the reason that such a recommendation coming from the commissions were never implemented, so that we can see how do we go forward. The other one, Chapasini, is the emphasis on rural development, that one of the reasons that we don't have the rural development is the low funding for the infrastructure or the poor spending of the resources for effective development. Now, I would be glad if we can be referred as an example of, because of the resources that were not sufficient in particular infrastructure, you cannot have the development. And typically the fundamental concern for me is about decentralization versus centralization, because it is captured here that there is a revenue under collection and a narrow base because of the overextended government structures. Are you saying that the structures are bloated and therefore the resources to fund those structures are so strained that the performance of those structures become redundant? Or can you refer us to those structures? And if we can say that those structures can be collapsed, can be dissolved, would the resources that were earmarked for this going to be very sufficient to be diverted to the ones that are needed? Because I would agree with you if you say that the overextended government structures may be responsible for the money that is supposed to go to where it is supposed to go, but instead there is a poor performance because of the overextension. Can it therefore resolve to say that such structures can be dissolved if there are any? And on page 11, Chaperson, there are realities that have been observed about this recentralization. Is it possible that we can reverse the centralization to decentralize, so that the performance of all the municipalities and all of the provincial parliament can achieve the goals that have been earmarked? But because it is to anyone understanding that centralization at times is the problem in order to achieve the goals, can you reverse that? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Inanna. I'm just going to check with the Commission if we still counted with the number of speakers, or you are happy if I take every member and then you respond. Happy.
Yes.
All right. Honorable Kibeto, and then Honorable Jaja, in that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, everybody. And apologies for being late, but it was a work practice totally beyond my control. But I'm very grateful to be here.
Sorry, comment. Honorable Nana, you switch off.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. The generation generating extra revenue in municipalities and not just sitting back and waiting for grants and funding, whether it's equitable share or any form of funding, as Professor just alluded to, it's the middle class who are not paying. That's the one problem in any municipality. Then we are sitting with a growing list of indigenous who can't pay. And we are sitting with an IDP that spells out exactly what the wishing list or the shopping list should be, what is being needed, etc., etc., and sometimes it's being blown out of proportion, and municipalities struggle to generate their own tax or broaden their own tax base. If I can just get a sense of what type of incentives one could sort of trigger in an already overburdened community. Most of the communities, most of our municipalities are totally overburdened in terms of generating these funds, and I'm not pessimistic, I'm an optimist. That's the first question, and it latches on to the recommendation you made in terms of the National Treasury granting greater flexibility to poor municipalities, categories B and 4. I'm very excited about this. This is something great. But now it also poses certain problems. And it latches on to what Chairperson said in terms of oversight. The greater flexibility is being granted to them to initiate innovative initiatives and approaches to address specific local problems. But I'm of the opinion that there are certain prerequisites, certain limitations when funding is being granted to municipalities. How far can they move or deviate from those stipulations? In what sense does it have implications for oversight and accountability, and also in terms of misappropriation of funds when there's not proper oversight, because they get leeway, they get totally they get greater flexibility, means you have the scope, and actually the stage is yours, and it creates implications for those, accountability, lack of oversight, and also the quality issue of the final product. I can just get clarity on those issues, that they might move in the direction, and God forbid, that there's systemic misappropriation, even corruption for that matter. I raise my case. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Kibet. Let us check in.
Thanks, Chairperson. The first issue I want to speak to is particularly on the input from the Chairperson or Prof. It's unfortunate, I'm not sure that I will be singing in the wrong funeral or not. But I think it's a big issue that I must raise here, because it's important, whilst we are acknowledging the challenges that we're having in the country, and the fact that our
group has not been beyond as member Sheikh Al said, has been very low, particularly after 2008. But also let me also say that our group has not, even from 94, has not been what is expected of post-independent countries. We have not grown beyond 5%. And but even there, I'm hoping also to get nothing, because part of the challenges of our economy are the adjustment that we have seen set by the some of the international financial institutions on how we should proceed as a country, which to a certain extent there are many discussions about that, some of them could not help the country to go beyond those percentages that we have. And I think it's important, once we acknowledge these challenges, we must be able to say because I've not heard a recommendation on some of the input that we have raised. How do we deal with such? Because continuously, we as a country will be having that challenge of how do we go beyond those limitations that I think are put as a pressure to developing countries such as South Africa. Because it's going to be difficult, Chair, to only want to deal with the issue of the fiscal management only, and then you don't talk about how do we actually manage properly the military process and make sure that you get the necessary revenue. I know that we're dealing with fiscal commission, but I'm raising it because sometimes they speak to each other on how one must be able to manage the process. Because my worry is that continuously we'll be managing how to minimize our process. That's why I was saying earlier on, I'm worried that I might be singing in the wrong funeral, because I don't think maybe it's the fiscal police, fiscal commission alone to deal with some of the issue. But those are economic challenges that as a country that we must be dealing with in order to sort our fiscal management processes. The second issue, Chair, that I also want to understand. I understand what has been raised, but when the times of the distress, you would find that government, national government, would want to take certain powers or certain functions and deal with them. I agree with the, and I sympathize with the recommendation that says we must not do a blanket approach. We need to understand the circumstances. But I would have hope that also we must be at least be given some light on the issues of capacity. Though we don't want to give a blanket approach, but we must be honest. we must be able to say where is capacity or what is our program in that makes sure that we have the right capacity as government in all spheres of government, in fact. Because at the moment, those spheres are still constitutionally relevant. They're still there. We are not removing them. The issue that you must talk to, where is the most, where is our capacity lies? Because part of the problem which I must raise in relation to the issue of the capital, what you call this thing, where money is taken.
So you can come back to that later.
No. Wait. I just want to. The issue that it's not a new thing where we are saying let's give the infrastructure grant to be done at this level. Remember, it's not a new thing. There was a reason why it was introduced in a manner that national government had to ring fence that amount for particular projects. You know why? Among the issue I think we have heard, because some of the money that was set for those grants were not actually most of the time used for those instances.
Okay.
I mean, you have departments going and passing ATP's budget, but in the course of the year, 6 months down the line, they finished their budget. They're now looking at other grants to actually to patch up. And that led to say that the grants must be ring-fenced for particular projects so that municipalities sometimes are not able to just willy-nilly change those budgets. So I'm saying, I hear that I'm sympathetic to a recommendation that is there, but it seems that we are going back to the same process that we were in before. Why are we reinventing? What's the story? Why are we reinventing the process? Why are we not dealing with challenges directly that set us not to be able to achieve what we want in relation to those particular grants? Thanks.
Ms. Bulele, please. Thank you. I think Ms. Ndaka is going to answer you on the first one. She's flagging there that she wants to ask that question. Honorable Gagam, and then I think the last speaker will be you, Honorable Porter. All right, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. I'm in Bachelors, because that's where us know where we are. Chairperson, just a few observations, and I think I actually concur with the concluding remarks of the Prof and his team, because it's very concerning at the moment. If you look at the contraction in our economy and its impact on local government, as the professor already alluded to. But now I'm going chapter by chapter where I've made notes, and if you can just assist me. If you look at chapter 3 on your recommendations, but on page 14 you took 3 specific provinces and you had a look at the provincial health budget balances. It would have been interesting to see if you added the Western Cape, how that would have looked. And the reason I'm asking that is, we are fully aware that there's at the moment, due to the quality of the healthcare that the Western Cape is providing, we're seeing a lot of influx from our neighboring province, and it's having a massive strain and effect on our service delivery on the residents in our own province itself. Would it then not make sense to the Prof and his team that should the equitable share which the Western Cape receive not actually be increased, because we're actually performing well? versus what the Eastern Cape are doing, where we are seeing the systematic failure of their health system. It's well known, it's well reported. I don't see that as a recommendation. It doesn't mean that would have been one thing to look at. Then on in chapter 4, Chair, and this is just a thought, and this is on page or slide 19. We do the categorization of the municipalities and so forth and the impact. I was just wondering, if you go to your B3 and B4 municipalities, we are seeing more and more residents move away from these municipalities to more densely populated, municipalities. Yet, the way that the equitable share is distributed according to the population size. And here is, we also note an increase in the number of indigent beneficiaries at these municipalities, meaning there's a massive need growing in your B3 and your B municipality areas as well. Is that, does the Commission perhaps have an idea how that can be addressed? Because I know that the B3 and the B municipalities for many years have had a battle that we need to really look at the way the equitable share formula works itself for them. It's not working for them because it seems the smaller the municipality, the less funds they get, and the more and the bigger the municipality that already has an income stream and ways of reinventing or looking at ways to increase the revenue stream, they are getting more money. Yet the objective of some of these grants are actually to assist our smaller rural municipalities. It is having the reverse effect at the moment. And to quote two good examples, if you look at Prince Albert Municipality, and if you look, for instance, at Lanesburg Municipality, it's very small municipalities, yet the equitable share they receive versus what their real need is. They've never been able to address their needs. This is a practical example, Chair. Chair, and then my final one, which relates to chapter 6. And you, at the moment, the National Department of Water Affairs and Sanitation is technically bankrupt. Do you believe that re-centralizing has been a massive contributor to that? And do you believe instead of re-centralization, we need to look at decentralizing core and crucial aspects of national government, that provincial governments must have more capacity to do that? And I'll use, for instance, your national water plan. I don't think it exists anymore. That's why you won't be able to find it on a website of the national government or department. And that is why in certain areas you'll see a regression of, for instance, the abilities of municipalities, for instance, to initiate water-saving initiatives. Even in the Western Cape, even though we are attempting across all our municipalities to ensure that, you know, water leakages are stopped and the mechanisms are put in place, ultimately some of these programs that we actually want to roll out to municipalities need national funding. But when you knock on the door, there's no money in the bank. And that's the all questions I have. Thank you, Jim.
And thank you, Honourable Simas. Honourable Porter.
Jim, I've been troubled by those who spoke before me, but I'm on slide 28. And then at the last sort of bullet, which is just under the last bullet, that many municipalities, I want to know, can you speak to how many and what who those municipalities are, and with regards to this, what is this amount in rand value? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable members, I think that brings us to the last part of the questions. I will now hand over to the FFC. Over to you, Prof.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's always good to hear the questions that come from members in terms of how they understand some of the issues that affect their daily lives. I actually wanted to start by responding to Honourable Tia Tia, but it's always a problem to respond to a question of a member of a member is not present, but for the record, let me say.
It has, if I may just respond on his behalf, he just came to me asking that he needs to run to another engagement. But you have an option to respond or not to respond on his specific question. But for the benefit of the meeting, if you could please respond to it.
Chair, let me then rather come back to responding to these points and respond rather to those members, Honourable Members present. Let me respond to your point that you make earlier to Honourable Chairperson. It's probably one of those lessons that countries like ourselves learn as a country in transition. And because our transition is still going to go for quite a while. I think sometimes our own citizens, our own leadership don't seem to get it that 20 years is just a small part of the process of transition. America has gone through 50 years of transition to get to 100, our constitution is more than 100 years old. So transition takes time. And there are lots of things that need to be put into place. But transition is also, especially our democracy, has got also its own challenges. And that's why we had worked in the academia and worked in the FFC and other research institutions always remind people that the citizens deserve who they vote for. And if you have serious issues of quality and competence at a municipal level, then that's what the citizens have voted for. And that's the level of capabilities of councillors that we have across the country. And there's nothing that the FFC can do today or tomorrow or ever until citizens understand at the municipal level in particular as to how they need to make their decisions in terms of electing. We can't interfere with that. And we can't even have an opinion on it in the sense of saying who should be elected, who should not be elected. The other thing is that, which is another thing that we will say to you on behalf of FFC, is that if you can't budget, you cannot govern. If you can't budget, you cannot govern. And we've also picked up over time that many of the municipalities are spending monies which they don't have. I mean, to run a government, a municipal government or provincial government, it's not different to how you run your own household. If you have money, you need to budget in terms of the revenue that you have, and you project on those revenues that you have in terms of your own income, and then you spend accordingly. Otherwise, you're going to go into deficit. And when it comes to provincial governments, the national rule is that provincial governments can't go into deficit. There's no deficit budgeting allowed for provincial governments, which is quite different when it comes to municipalities. So it is then incumbent on provinces to then ensure that municipalities can't put the budget forward or even get the budget approved for that matter. Councillors approve budgets where there's no revenue. I mean, if you got a responsibility and there's no money in your budget, then surely the provincial legislatures needs to intervene in terms of section 139 of the constitution and do their work and do their oversight and intervene in that. But to responding to the points that you have made, and I think it's quite critical that we start looking at what are the capabilities required to be a councillor. I think we are at that point, given the nature and extent of the collapse that's going on. When we get to section 100 and section 139 of the provinces and municipality, you effectively start talking about the Detroit option. And the Detroit option in the US is where the city of Detroit was declared bankrupt. And we have a number of that within our country in terms of problem municipalities. And I'm happy that you raised somebody raised the matter of the so on the other points that you've raised on the equitable and conditional ground, I'll ask Mr. Tao to respond to it, but not now. I just want to cover the ones now because I know it's also Friday, you know. I think the issue around the point that Honourable Kivido was raising around guarantees and loans, it's the same as a household. You need to have collateral to be able to go for a guarantee, and guarantee has got multi-year effect when it comes to municipalities. when they go for loans for infrastructure. And it pains me as to how municipalities are sometimes loaning money to pay salaries, but also loaning money to against the conditional grant. It's breaking the law. It's breaking the law. If you use a conditional grant which was for the purposes of doing a particular service and you want to use that as a guarantee for a loan, it's breaking the law. It's breaking the PFMA. It's breaking the Municipal Systems Act. Whoever does it is breaking the law, and there needs to be consequence management by that. I can't say whether they call you a gangster or whatever, but it's breaking the law. If you break the law, then there are clear mechanisms for intervention from the provincial legislature and from national government, because you can't do that. And part of the consequence management matter, which I would think is probably to say that if municipalities are taking the wrong decisions and create fiscal risks for municipal government, then the councillors must take individually and collectively responsibility for it. And we need to find ways of starting to see the role, turning the ball in terms of accountability. Because what goes for public servants must go for political representatives. Whether they sit in national legislature, to provincial legislatures, to councillors, whether they sit in the constitutional structure like myself and other commissioners, if we make the wrong decisions and we create risks to our country's fiscus and create serious problems for credit agencies that don't know about it, look at us, then we must take the fall for it. The consequence management needs to happen. Because the state doesn't belong to any single individual. It belongs to the citizens of South Africa. So I think in terms of the guarantees and just in terms of my judgment and just in terms of what's been said by you, Honourable Chairperson, and by Honourable Kivido on the loans and guarantees, I mean, we would support that. Even if you ask us to give an opinion on the matter, we will write for you an opinion that gives, and we pull on our constitutional authority to say this is out of kilter with our legislation as envisaged this. Then on the point that Honourable Hinana raises, I think I'm going to ask Mr. Dawood to respond to on the rural development infrastructure stuff and the funding of infrastructure. But the key point is, which you trigger the issue that is quite clear, which is functionality. We continuously say that municipalities must be given those certain functions. We also argue for that. But there's municipalities that it doesn't matter what you do that will never be able to perform certain functions. It's the issue as capacity, and it's not capacity in terms of people, because we always think that having the right set of people is a panacea to sort it out. If you don't have economic and fiscal capacity, and there's no cash going around, there's no economic activity in a municipality, it doesn't matter what you do. It doesn't matter what you do. In fact, what we're doing is that we're putting money in a dark hole, the money disappears in certain municipalities. The national transfers go directly to salaries, and it goes directly to pay Eskom bill, which some municipalities don't even seem to understand what it's all about and how that bill gets consumed and put together. So we have a system that we're talking about in the symmetry with an A and a B and a C and sometimes a D municipality. But the reality is the issue of functionality. We haven't looked properly at the functionality of municipalities, and it's probably time that we have to review how we put together our municipal system. And part of our own work for next year is hopefully will shed some light on it. If you ask my own opinion as the chairperson of the FFC, which which doesn't carry the view of the other commissioners because they haven't canvassed with them. There are certain municipalities that should close down. It's as serious as that. Because those municipalities are budgeting where they don't have money. And they create a risk to the citizens living in those areas because those municipal governments belong to those citizens. And that's the issue of accountability. So in terms of that, it's an open debate, I'm basically saying to you. We are concerned how it's happening, how the decentralization process is happening, we are concerned about, because we also want to protect the constitutional imperatives of municipalities and local government and provincial government. But we are acutely aware of the fact that we don't have a system of asymmetry, where you give functions to those that have actually proven they've got the capabilities. And it's not only people again, it's about financial, economic capabilities, about systems, it's about process of doing things, about legislation, it's about whether your councillors understand their responsibilities, and whether your councillors know they're accountable. I come from Bontville in the Cape, a child of Bontville, and I can say to you, what did you say? I don't want to cast aspersions to anybody, but I think there is a need to look at how do we get people to represent ourselves and to make sure that they're accountable to councillors, to them. On the issue, so I think on infrastructure part we'll ask Hans to address that. Then on Honourable Schaefer, I hope I'm saying it correct. If I don't, I must be Cape Flats, because Alison is proper. The issue of growth numbers and the trajectory about that is we measure ourselves because the National Development Plan is not a piece of legislation that was approved, as you will have in Malaysia, where the National Development Plan is legislated and it set the trend for the next 30 years and nobody can divert from it. But everybody has approved in the provincial and national and municipal council the National Development Plan. So the National Development Plan sets certain targets. And our reflection of that, of the point that we're making, is against those targets set relative to where we are. And that's why we won't move out of that, because our thing is to identify what are the economic targets that were set by government, but also look at what are the hurdles to get to that. And part of those hurdles are the points that I wanted to raise in trying to decipher what Honourable Tia Tam was saying. Because it's got to do with policy decisions and policy consistency. Because people look at you and they look at the economics at the end of the day is about perceptions. And growth and how we deal with it, it's all about perceptions. And it's got to do with how do you do the correct political messaging in your own legislature, in your own government, in the national government, in the municipal councils, and in the whole of South Africa. And the messaging across the country for the last 10, 11 years has not been good. You know, the fallout in your own municipality, where municipality cities are the engines of growth and development and infrastructure investment. And the messaging has not been good on the political governance side and knock-on effect of that in the administration. And the same can go for the rest of the country. The messaging around how fraud and corruption has been rampant within the country is not a good message, especially when it comes to the public purse, relative to what's happening in business, in corporates, and that. And the whole issue around the competition and the competition commission. I haven't heard a legislature chairperson, sorry I have to put my jacket off because I don't want to if the questions came. I haven't heard any provincial legislature saying anything that came out of the Because the citizens, it's your citizens in the Western Cape. It's your citizens in the other provinces and municipalities. But I haven't heard the provincial legislature or any premier across the country or any executive mayor or mayor across the country say anything around the collusion that the competition commission has discovered around bread, around cement, around those public goods, private goods which the citizens buy from private companies to deliver services into both our country. I haven't heard a word about that. And it's an indictment on our political leadership not to be able, at the level where it matters, to decodify those messages. Because it's your citizens that vote for you and there's a collusion around bread. Whether it's the sugar content of it, whether it's the pricing fixing, whether it's got to do with the agricultural products, whether it's got to do with the wheat, and you can go on and on and on. And it's hard not to be able to see. Why are these people not saying anything around that? And then it's got to do with the issue of government has put into place fiscal incentives and the stimulus after the shocks that has happened. And you know, if something happens in the US, it knocks the UK as its main trading partner, and then it knocks us as its main trading partner of the UK. So that's the way the cycle works. And in many ways, part of what we're experiencing currently has got less to do with South Africa in terms of economic growth, but also more to do with South Africa in terms of how we can sort to create stability and ensure growth around that. Then there's the issue of prudent financial spending. I think many institutions, whether they're constitutional, whether they're provincial government, local government, departments, there are spending concerns. The national policy trajectory is that we need to get value for money. But there needs to be a way that we ourselves, or you yourselves as legislators, look at what does value for money mean? Because we're not getting it, I have to do this because I'm representing constitutional structure. We have politicians talking about value for money, and that goes in national parliament, provincial legislature. Everybody talks about value for money. And then you have our young children, you know, those new post-Mandela born children like my own kids. What is value for money? And I said, I don't know. I think you must write a letter to the provincial legislature and ask the member, what is value for money? Because we're not able to unpack to be able to keep the officials accountable for the spending that's going on. And that's where the wastage goes, because we only see irregular and waste expenditure. But we don't see the value that some of the spending is adding. You know? Why is there a dip? Why must there be a dip in our metric results? Why? It was a 20th division, why? I mean, I was at school, it was 50% and you pass. Is it got to do with the input in terms of the teachers' inputs into education? It's got to do with the quality of our teachers that can't pass grade 6 mathematics, and then they stand in front of our children, our teacher children in mathematics. And I see that as a form of abuse, because you're abusing those children whose parents' voices are voiceless, because they can't protest in the way of, because they're not paying the way we pay that in the middle class, putting our children in the schools that we're going to pay. What are we doing about it? So that's the issue about spending. And we need to interrogate, and I sometimes worry that because of our political electoral system that we're not able to ask the hard questions. I remember when I was working for Trevor Emmanuel in the days, we call it the glory days of the Treasury, you know. Trevor Emmanuel used to say, he can't understand why members of his own political party don't ask him the hard question. Why must the opposition ask the hard question? And the same goes for yourselves. Why don't you ask the hard question to your own leadership around spending and the return of value around that? Because that leads to a question of looking at quality and access and the financing of our services. The quality of education, access to education, health, welfare, and other services. So So that was my drive, but that I thought I need to tell the Honourable that left the town. Then the issue around that you raised, Honourable Schaefer, around the revenue stream for municipalities. I think the point that I would like to make is, yes, the middle class must not be punished for being innovative. It's correct. And to be able to push the innovative economy around some of these things. But I think the middle class should not be allowed to break the law either. And part of that is that we need to have a functional city of Cape Town. We need to have a functional city of Cape Town. And if there's a dip in the revenue of the city of Cape Town, because we, including myself that lives in this city, and others that sit in the seaborne bend and that don't pay their revenue, then you're going to set a situation that there's not enough revenue to keep the city of Cape Town functional. That's the issue for us. So we need to look at how we can ensure that protect the municipal government, but also protect the citizens that needs to be served around. And that's the reason why I raised the point. Because the city of Cape Town has spoken to me about, to us about the effects of it. Because there is water harvesting that's going on, there is people getting off the grid, and people are quite innovative. But your innovation cannot be to a point where you just cut off where is the municipal basket of services, the free basic basket of services. You cut off, and that's free, and then the other things you use your own innovation. And so the city has got some innovative ways of how they're looking at it. But the point that I was raising, as the provincial legislature, which is responsible for the whole of the province, don't forget the risk to the property taxes, because that's the next element, because the city must make its revenue. And that's got a collateral effect, an impact on the rest of all our citizens within the province. So that was the reason why I'm raising it. I thought Honourable Summers' point about the issue that you raised about influx control, I think he actually didn't mean that. Because in the past days we had the influx control matter, and it had some serious pain in South African society. You probably mean the movement of people, the migration of people. And I understand that the population data is a key point of an inequitable share allocation. I fully agree with you. But what you shouldn't forget is that I don't want to speak for the Treasury, but they are indigent related conditional grants. And the one of it is the National Electricity Program, Electrification Program, Integrated National Electricity, where it pays for an element in the free basic services. And there are others into it. Is that substantive? Is it enough? Well, it will never be enough. But I think you're right if you say to us we need to go further and interrogate that and bring in the factor of the indigent people into that, so that we're able to give you a much better picture of the problems. And I need to say, Chair, I mean, I've raised it with our staff yesterday and before. Part of our problem is the past is catching us. The past lives in the present. Since I've been chairperson, I've been saying that we can't go to, especially your province, because we get difficult questions from your province. We can't come to the Western Cape and we don't have the Western Cape story. Right? And we get the same from Gauteng and KZN. And that's why we endeavor in the next submission, because remember, AMS has been around since the 1st of July 2017. So in the next submission, if we don't address some specifics to the Western Cape, then you can say that the record will show that you've said that. but because we're going to go into the specifics so that we give you what we're saying about the national picture, but here's the more specific in the recommendations that we are making in terms of municipalities in the Western Cape. That's the undertaking that we will do. So we'll work on a special page or two pages within our submission. It will be thicker this time around. To help you with that. Can I ask the Honourable Chairperson with your permission that Khalid and Dawood and Sasa quickly respond to the infrastructure questions and the points that was made in terms of Sasa. Thank you.
Thank you, Prof. The platform is all yours, sirs and madams.
Thank you, Chair. I think Prof has covered a lot of the questions. I'll just comment on two of them. With respect to Honorable Hinana and Chacham's comments on re-centralization, I think that what we are saying is that there are problems of delivery, whether it be municipalities or provinces, but the answer is not to simply centralize. In most instances, that's not the answer, because location of the function is neither here nor there. But what is important is oversight, and Section 154 of the Constitution actually enjoins national and provincial governments to build the capacity of municipalities to enable them to carry out their functions. So those are where the serious gaps lie. We see many quick fixes or short-term solutions to building capacity, projects like the Yenza Manje, Back to Basics, Project Consolidate, all overlapping objectives, but no real impact in terms of improving capacity. And as I think the Chair alluded to, it's not about only building the capacity of people. We also need to look at capacity from an organizational and institutional perspective, because you can train a person to be innovative, but if the department where he works is not allowing him to implement those innovative methods, then it's for nothing. And I think just on Honourable Simmons' point about including the Western Cape, your point is taken. I just think from the lens that we used with respect to Chapter 3 was looking at the aspect of expenditure crews. So we looked at Gauteng, KZN and Eastern Cape simply because they have the highest number of expenditure crews. The Western Cape actually has the lowest across all the provinces. Colin?
Okay, so I'll just answer a few questions related to the conditional grants and the equitable share. With respect to the Honourable Member raising the issue of conditional grants, and the performance of conditional grants, our results show that in fact for rural municipalities, conditional grants actually incentivize a decline in capital expenditure. So it's very much in line with the Honourable Member's view that quite often conditional grants are not being spent for the purposes that they are intended to. With respect to the low funding on infrastructure, the way that the fiscal system is designed is that it incentivizes those municipalities that spend the funds, and it disincentivizes those municipalities that don't spend the funds. So quite often, when you don't spend the allocated resources, your budget gets cut the next year. What is quite important from the Commission's perspective is that in a case of fiscal constraints, how effectively are we actually utilizing the funds allocated? Now, in the assessment that we did with respect to some of the conditional grants, we actually found that in one particular province, over 100 million rand of conditional grants was spent. But when you looked at the actual delivery of services, you actually found that nothing was delivered. So there's resources that are being allocated, but we're not always optimizing the resources that we are receiving from the funds. Then there was Honourable Member raised the issue of how can we incentivize or trigger own revenue municipalities, particularly in cases where people are course, not paying. Well, the recommendation that we made is that when you look at municipalities' own revenue collection, our research found that quite often there are two components to the revenue collection. The one component is that it's part of your tax base that can't afford to pay the tariffs. But there's also a big component that can pay the tariffs that the municipality is not collecting from. And so a recommendation that we made was to incentivize municipalities through the local equitable share formula to actually boost all the revenue collection. And that's one of the big challenges that currently we're having is with respect to revenue collection and public systems in municipalities. So that recommendation is there to actually encourage municipalities that if you actually increase your effort, you will be rewarded through the equitable share by getting a larger share of the equitable share formula. Then with respect to the honourable question, member's question regarding the broadening of conditional grounds and the impact of oversight, we do agree with the honourable member. Broadening the conditional grounds should not be an open ended process or a blank check for municipalities to decide for themselves what they can utilise the funds for. So there should be limitations even though you're increasing the scope. So whilst you are providing municipalities with flexibility, there should also be stringent oversight measures in place that monitor the way that those resources have been utilized. And just to concur with the comments that were raised by my colleague Ms. Peters, that what we've generally found was that inevitably, when even in the current state, current context, where we have the gaps is really with respect to oversight failures from your provincial and national government, particularly with respect to your departments of local governments in the provinces. And that's something that has been raised in quite a few reviews that have been conducted at the national level. I think I'd like to leave it at that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Is there another speaker that has not been responded to?
Yeah,
Chair. Okay. Yes, Chair.
Thank you. I think there was a question from Honourable Bota in latitude. Are there other municipalities that were covered in the study? On the data and that. Khalid? Do you remember?
Okay, just, sorry, could you
repeat? I was on 28 the slide, and I wanted to know with your last bullet there, what are those municipalities now, many of those municipalities? Are you talking about in that, and what is, in terms of land value, what is the number?
Sorry, are you referring to the last bullet on slide 28?
Parts were saying many municipalities do not pursue costs recovery for services provided.
Oh, sorry.
Can I, Chairperson? Can I respond to that by saying, can you give us, I've noted your question on the report, can you give us permission to come back to you within a week so that we can all just send it to you on paper, because it's also very helpful on that.
That's fine.
Thank
you.
All right. I think that's probably the last bite. If you don't mind, Mr. Dawood, to switch off your mic there. Thanks. Chairperson, I think Prof, on your remarks on some of the salient issues, for instance on the anti-competitive behavior, I think it depends on when are these issues raised, but immediately when you were talking I was trying to respond by checking what has been dealt, what has been done and what has not been done. I think different political parties respond differently, and one of the issues that I can relate to now, I can look at, is the aspect anti-competitive behavior on the pharmaceutical prices. We dealt with that substantively, and a number of other issues prior to that, even the contractors that have been getting continuous work without giving competition, opening up competition in KZN and other areas. But here, we've been doing a number of that. I mean, the Human Settlements Department, I think, is a classical example. When Minister Matukizela first arrived, he had a problem where only certain companies were getting work, those big, the big five, that's how we used to call them. But now you started seeing a difference, so more than 25 new companies started getting work, opening up the competition, but also giving opportunities to smaller to medium-sized companies. Because we need to address the structure of the economy. You need to really zoom in and say, what do we do to reflect the true picture of South Africa in the economy, so that the inclusive economy, you know, speaks to the road that we need to traverse going forward. So I think your statement there is received, and I take the point that maybe we're not speaking enough, but we do, and we are, and we'll continue to do so. But the messaging of how well do we project that message, does it get received well by everybody? Do they get to hear what we actually say? Because sometimes as politicians, we talk to ourselves. We don't really get the message carried out properly, that the person in the street is able to say, he spoke for me, you know, she spoke for me, instead of us talking to ourselves. But thank you very much for this presentation, and we will continue to engage you. I've heard the point around municipalities not willing to hear your call, so we will arrange for sessions. So even the standing committee on local government, that is the direct oversight over the municipalities in terms of the accountability. So we'll definitely engage and see how we can work together on that. On that note, I think it has come to a point where we can say to everyone present, we have come to an end, and thank you very much. I'm told there's lunch for our guests and for the honourable members. You are more than welcome to join, and it's right in the dining hall on the other side. The meeting has come to an end, but I'll request honourable members to stay for a little bit to deal with some of the resolution. It won't be too long. Thank you very much. Thank you. Anything that you want to raise, but I have to respond to the prof because we do speak. I can't speak for other parties, but we speak. Can I get an indication of what you think is a resolution that you want us to take from here? Anything?
I just want to reiterate the question that I asked, that it be forwarded to this committee in writing.
Any other member? What did I raise initially?
What did you raise?
It's fine, we'll remember that. But can I request that we take that one, that Honourable Voter. If there's anything that you remember, you can send to the committee coordinator. She will coordinate it by email if there's something that you forgot. But I don't want to open that can of worms. But, ma'am?
Chair, if you indulge me, and if I'm out of line, then say so. I'm just thinking, would it not be useful for FFC to have an engagement directly with municipalities or representatives of municipalities so that they hear?
I'm just thinking,
this is tied to what Mr. Walker said. What will entice municipalities to actually engage the FFC? It's too simple to explain. The issue of equitable share. You get all of them on board, believe me, because most rural municipalities have an issue with equitable share. That's why I briefly touched on it.
Mm.
And secondly, Chair as well, and I think the Prof probably misunderstood what I was trying to get at it. Taking the Eastern Cape and the Western Cape Health Departments and weighing them up, it's that, and this ties in with what Minister Mbombo normally asks as well, we are offering a world-class service, but the funds we are getting, our equitable share we get, does not reflect the increase in the number of patients that we cater for, and that is what I meant with we need to look at our equitable share as we increase.
Mm.
Now, just like it to be noted as well, because I didn't make any xenophobic anger, because purely the money doesn't follow the service we deliver.
Yeah, that's fair enough. That's a serious problem between us and Gauteng, by the way. I mean, we're getting 10% where we should be getting more than 15%. So it's a fact, but I think they don't have that much voice from the National Treasury. The National Treasury and the Minister of Finance and the Cabinet nationally don't take the voices. That's why I asked that question right up front, because we talk and we express and they try, but that call does not get heard beyond just listening, because you want that to be implemented. If there's nothing else, okay, Honourable Kiveta.
Thank you, Chair. I think the roping in of our local government into this type of discussion is just a must. I'm referring to messaging. How do we get the message out there where the real, as you say, is in the coalface of service delivery? He was mentioning, and I think it touched me when he said mentioned the whole issue of price fixing of bread, for instance. And specifically bread, a staple food of millions of poor and hungry people. And they don't even know about price fixing or about collusion, because these messages are not being given to them. Some of us don't even know, myself, how these things are possible, how it is being schemed and scammed. So it is that one, and also in terms of the classist issues in municipalities. That was raised today, in no uncertain terms, the rich and the poor and the middle class and the indigents and those who can pay and those who can't pay, in terms of leveling the playing fields, or working out a new formula, broadening the tax base in terms of revenue. How do we revisit the MMFA and have another look at how spending should take place, and the leeway given to certain municipalities to have innovative projects and to address their local problems, etc. Who are those municipalities and what type of leeway do they get? How are they evaluated and monitored, etc.? I have no problem with it, but just to for the sake of messaging and for the sake of capacitation, because it's all about, we say we are servants of the people, and we are. wonderful servants of the people. Thank God for that. And but I think if we can take it that, to that level, it will be great. Thank
you. Right. I'm going to request the honored members that in our next meeting, we invite the Minister of Local Government and
yes.
his department so that we engage them, because they interact with municipalities
yes.
all the time.
Yes, sir.
So that at their government, they've got their governance session in order to invite
yes.
the executive there
yes.
if they don't invite them already.
Yes.
But otherwise we want to take this where it belongs. It should go to the municipalities. So are we all happy that the resolution be that we invite the Minister of Local Government and his department to this committee?
Yes.
So that we are all able to interact in this meeting. On that note, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
What is the last race?
We have
four.
Okay. Okay.
Have instructed by all of the
yes. 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 Y